I'm Joe Dante.
Legendary director Joe Dante.
And I'm Josh Olson.
Oscar-nominated screenwriter Josh Olson.
And nobody loves movies as much as we do.
Nobody's sane.
And we have a podcast.
Each episode, we track down other filmmakers, comedians, rock stars, authors, and artists, and talk to them about movies.
But not about their movies. Everybody does that.
We talk to them about the movies they love and the movies that have, well,
made them who they are.
Which is why we call our show The Movies That Made Me.
From legendary giants to this year's Oscar winners.
We know them all and we've seen them all.
So check out The Movies That Made Me, the Movie Lovers Podcast.
Available everywhere you find good podcasts. Well, actually, it's available wherever you find podcasts, even the bad ones, but ours is really good.
That's the idea.
I never like to take credit that is not due to me. Okay. However, on this one, I will take credit.
Okay.
I fought my ass off to have Tia be in that role. And, you know, because I know rock and roll, I know how to shoot music.
Welcome, 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 one and all. This is Drew Taylor, joined as always by Charles Hood.
Hello, everybody. Yes, we're here.
We're here, we're back, but we're also starting something anew.
Yeah.
Charles, something, we're going out to an undiscovered country. We're reaching out for something grander
yes.
than what's come before. And do you want to tell people what that is?
Well, yeah, we're here. It's Light the Fuse presents The Directors, and I'm sure you heard Kevin Blumenfeld's wonderful new theme that he provided for us. The music is great, as always. Thank you, Kevin. And yeah, we're here to interview directors about their iconic Paramount movies. Does that sound like a good description?
That sounds like a great description. We've got a ton of great guests coming up. We are not at liberty to reveal all of our lineup, but we really have some fun chats with some of your favorite filmmakers and some of our favorite filmmakers, so we're super excited. Before we get into this, we have to tell people, Charles, that hours before recording this podcast, I tested positive for COVID. I had just come back from Sundance and was feeling real low, and yes. then it came back. Those two lines that we don't want to see.
I feel, you know, you're usually leading the way in these interviews, and you messaged me beforehand, and you were like, "You're going to have to take the lead," and I was like, "All right, yes. I got to step up. This is my big moment.
This is your moment." And I think you did a wonderful job. But I just want to tell people that in case I sound very different in this one, and I don't talk very much. But Penelope was so sweet. And we absolutely loved chatting with her about all things Wayne's World. We haven't talked about our first guest, but it's Penelope Spheeris, and we're talking about Wayne's World, and it is awesome.
Yes.
It's a movie that meant so much to me and to Charles and to our entire generation, I feel like.
What an important movie for our childhood. I mean, just...
Hugely important, yeah. It was...
Yeah.
They sold it at McDonald's for $4.99 at Christmas. I mean, this movie was everywhere. You have no idea.
Yeah. And Penelope just knocked it out of the park. You know, it was the first SNL movie that was done in something like 12 years. The only one before it was Blues Brothers. And this is the one that kicked off a whole slew of them in the 90s. And just, it's a fantastic movie and we love it so much. And she's such an amazing interview. So I'm so excited for everyone to hear this.
Yeah, it's really, really great. So yeah, with keeping in mind that I am on the other end of this Zoom dying inside, Charles, thank you for leading the way and to conceding to my invisible appearance. Penelope was asking where I was. I was just a black screen because I looked like death.
Yes, we were a little worried about you, but you were fine. You're here now and everything's good. Before we start, I do just want to say one thing that we mentioned a couple of times, I think, the titles of her amazing documentaries that she made in the 80s. And just for reference of what they are, The Decline of Western Civilization, she made part one and part two. The first one, I think, was 1981, and it was about the Los Angeles punk rock scene. And then the second one was from 1988, I think, and it was about the heavy metal scene of the time. And so, you know, that was it's just incredible documentaries you should check out if you can. And they're just we mentioned them, the titles, casually here just so you have reference of what they are. And also another thing I wanted to point out that we forgot to talk to her about is that obviously we're the official Mission Impossible podcast. There's multiple scenes in Wayne's World where they play Mission Impossible music, and we didn't talk to her about that.
I blame you, Charles. I was on another plane of existence. Okay. So
that's
yeah.
fair. It yeah. is my fault. Yeah, yes. That's true. I mean, it's just, there are great bits, as there are so many in these movies, and they use the Mission Impossible theme, Lalo's theme from the old show. And so anyway, just wanted to mention that because we don't ask her about that foolishly, but it's an amazing interview. Can't wait for y'all to hear.
I also want to say, Charles, that you can buy the Decline of Western Civilization box set. She made a third movie after yes. Wayne's World, and it is available on the Shout Factory box set. It looks like there are 34 in stock, so go and get yours. I think it's out of print, so check it out.
Get it while you can.
Yep. All right, we'll be back afterwards.
Well, welcome, Penelope. This is so great to talk to you. This is amazing. You're a legend. We're so excited to talk to you about Wayne's World in particular, I think, is a Paramount classic, and we wanted to get into that and a few other things as well. But, can you start by telling us how you came onto that project?
Well, I got the original script from Scott Yoslow at the Gersh Agency in New York. He sent it to me, and I read all the scripts I got, because at that time I really was trying to get my foot in the studio system door, you know. Mm-hmm. And I loved the Wayne's World script. I loved the Wayne's World skit and SNL, of course. So I had to go to a few meetings. I mean, like, I don't know, 6, 8, something like that. A lot of meetings. But I was also up for a job to shoot a documentary at Patton State Hospital for the criminally insane. So I was at the hospital when I called my agent and said, "What's up with Wayne's World?" And he said, "You got the gig." And I'm like, "Oh man, I'm so happy, because now I don't have to do this nut house job, you know." Is that like politically incorrect?
I think it works.
I'm not sure. It's okay.
Works,
yeah. It's okay. You're grandfathered in. You're okay. You can say whatever you want.
All right. Right on. Grandmothered in.
Yeah.
Sorry. Yes. Yes. Did you have any hesitation from it being, you know, based on a sketch? I mean, there had been Blues Brothers. The Blues Brothers movie had been done, you know, 12 years before, but that was the only one. So was there any hesitation about adapting a sketch into a movie?
Well, funny you should ask, Charles, because I didn't know, honestly, if I could do it or not. But here's the thing. Everybody kept asking me, are you sure you can translate a 5-minute sketch into a 90-minute movie? And what am I going to say? Gee, no, I don't think I can do it. No, I had to lie, you know. I had to just freaking lie and say, I can definitely do this. I have absolutely no question in my mind about whether or not I could turn this into a real movie. There's no problem at all. And I just, you know, faked it till I made it, you know.
And when you had those, you know, 6 to 8 meetings, did you have to come in and sort of pitch what your vision of the movie was?
No, actually, most of the meeting, this is hilarious. It's funny you would ask this, because most of the meetings that I was scheduled to have, I sat in the hallway waiting for the executives to show up there on the second floor at Paramount. And they were late and sometimes never made it. And so I only really had, you know, maybe 3 meetings, something like that. And it got to a point where, because Lorne has these guys booked for writing and appearing on Saturday Night Live, we had a cutoff point at the end of the summer where Wayne and Garth had to jump in a limo and get their ass back to New York to do SNL. So Paramount was a little bit in a corner in terms of hiring a director. And I think I got the gig because the time was tight. I knew Lorne before he was even doing Saturday Night Live. I had been friends with him. And also I had just done the Metal Years, the Decline, second Decline movie. So it was just a series of, you know, circumstances that got me the gig, you know.
Right. And so that script came in. You said the script was great. Was there anything that you asked for in terms of changes before you went into, you know, pre-production or anything like that? Were there changes that you wanted?
No. I didn't ask for, as I recall, I got a call from my agent and he goes, Penelope, before your contract is signed, you are not allowed to rock the boat. So basically, you have to agree with everybody on everything. And then once your contract is signed, you can pipe up and say what you really think. So they were working on the contract. Like I said, everything was like backed up time-wise tight. And I got a call from John Goldwyn. Penelope, please come into my office. I must talk to you about something very important. So I go in there and he says, look, people are saying that you're not making decisions. And if you don't do that, you're not going to do this movie. And I'm thinking, don't rock the boat, you know. I was trying to balance, you know, the two evils there. But anyway, so the contract got signed and I got to put my two cents in, of course. The script changes, and there were many. I mean, you know, the colors of pages that people use to update the script?
Yeah.
There's like 12 colors, you know, there's, you know, salmon, marigold, verde, I don't know. And so we went through all the colors three times. That's how many. Yeah.
Why were there so many changes? Was it comedy punch-ups or was it more budget reasons or something else?
It wasn't really budget reasons. It's because there's a real difference between TV writers and how they work and movie writers and how they work, you know, in a traditional situation with a film, you get the script, you know, you might do a few changes, but you pretty much follow the script. In TV, you know, like Bonnie and Terry Turner, God bless them, that they were writing every day and handing me new pages. And I finally had to make a rule that I would not shoot anything that didn't have a lead time on it. Like I needed to have, I forgot, 24 or 48 hours with the shoot pages in my hand before I would shoot it. And they actually followed the rule. So that helped, you know.
Oh, that's good.
No kidding. And because they're used to, I heard that when they shoot the on Saturday Night Live, when they got the host there and, you know, they go to a commercial break, they'll hand the host brand new material during the commercial break. And so he or she has to look at it and get it together before 3, 2, 1, you're on, you know?
Right.
Yeah. So that's how they're accustomed to operating. And it was the scramble, you know?
Yeah. We'll be back with more from Penelope Spheeris after the break.
Hi, I'm Joe Dante.
Legendary director Joe Dante.
And I'm Josh Olson.
Oscar-nominated screenwriter Josh Olson.
And nobody loves movies as much as we do.
Nobody's sane.
And we have a podcast.
Each episode, we track down other filmmakers, comedians, rock stars, authors, and artists, and talk to them about movies.
But not about their movies. Everybody does that.
We talk to them about the movies they love and the movies that have, well,
made them who they are.
Which is why we call our show The Movies That Made Me.
From legendary giants to this year's Oscar winners.
We know them all and we've seen them all.
So check out The Movies That Made Me, the Movie Lovers Podcast.
Available everywhere you find good podcasts. Well, actually, it's available wherever you find podcasts, even the bad ones. But ours is really good.
That's the idea.
Check out our new NBA show, Beyond the Arc, part of the CBS Sports Podcast Network, where you can find me, John Gonzalez, NBA insider Bill Reiter, and Ashley Nicole Moss 5 days a week talking all things NBA. Whether you're looking for insightful discussions, upbeat commentary, breaking news, interviews, or coverage of all the biggest stories in the NBA, our new show is the place to be 5 days a week. Download and follow Beyond the Arc on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and wherever you get your favorite podcasts.
What was the biggest change out of those revisions, do you remember? Like, was it pretty seismic shifts in scenes or tone or structure? Or what was the biggest change from those?
I know the studio was asking for, you know, like what they call set pieces, you know, moments that had a big, a lot of people involved in a big location and whatever, such as Alice Cooper at, we shot him at the Universal Amphitheater. You know, they need a set piece here and there. I think, you know, the biggest variation from the script, and you're probably going to get into this further later, but was the way that I chose to shoot the Bohemian Rhapsody scene. That wasn't written that way. The song was in the script when I got the script. That was in the original draft, which I always thought was funny because Wayne and Garth wanted to portray themselves as headbangers, you know, as like metalheads, you know. But basically, they were just these nerdy posers, and that's what made them funny. And anyway, so yeah, like if they, you know, if they were really truly headbangers, they would have been listening to Maiden Iron Maiden or Judas Priest or Black Sabbath in the car, because Queen is more sort of like an orchestral rock and roll band. You know, it's not real metal, you know.
Yeah.
Anyway, don't kill me, Brian May. Okay.
And did Freddie Mercury have to watch the scene before? Because he passed away soon after the movie before the movie came out. What was the timeline there?
What happened? I had been doing, before I got the Wayne's World gig, I had been doing what they call Street Rat A&R over at MCA Records. And I remember they had this huge party over at the Queen Mary, because put it together, Queen Mary, Freddie Mercury, and Queen, big party. And I went to the party, but Freddie wasn't there. And everybody was going, why isn't Freddie here? Why isn't Freddie here? Oh, he's sick. And then it was soon thereafter that we knew he was very, very sick. And it is my understanding that he never really saw the movie. If somebody has proof otherwise, I'd love to know it. I did the, you know, the music video for Wayne's World for Bohemian Rhapsody. So I went and did so much research on Queen. And I think I saw every piece of footage ever shot on them and learned to love Freddie even more by doing so, you know?
Yeah. And so you said that the script was one thing and then you had something different for this Bohemian Rhapsody sequence. So what was it in the script? Because I think I've heard before you and Mike Myers kind of clashed a little bit, right? He didn't want to do the headbanging or something in the car.
Yeah, I mean, the headbanging was not, you know, what's funny is, you see that file cabinet over there? I've got the original final draft in there.
And oh, wow.
I meant to look at it before I talked to you. So bad on me. I should have, but 90% sure that, you know, the word headbanging was not used in the description of the action of the scene. It was the guys get in the car and they're going over to Stan Mikita's or wherever the hell they were going. And that was it, you know, and a song is playing. So I decided that's going to be the title sequence, you know. And I had previously shot a film in 86 or 7, something like that, with John Cryer and Flea from the Chili Peppers. And I used that same thing where they're headbanging in a car, but they were headbanging to Hava Nagila. Hava Nagila. Yeah. And their heads were going like that. And it was great. So I knew that that was funny and I knew that it worked. And so when we were shooting, we had to shoot like two nights, I think, down in Covina. And it was it was hard for those guys because I knew I had a great scene there and I knew I had to cover it really thoroughly. So I kept doing it over and over and over again for like two nights in a row. And yeah, Mike got a headache and complained a little bit, but you know, he asked for Advil, and I guess the only thing we disagreed about was whether or not it was funny. And I think he kind of finally came over to my side here 30 years later.
That's good. Okay, so let's see. There's so many sequences to talk about. I watched the 4K disc the other night. It's like the 1,000th time I've seen this movie. I was curious, the airplane that flies overhead. Did you shoot a model for that, or what was that?
Yes, definitely a model. I'm sorry you were able to discern that.
Well, I'm a director. I do think about that kind of stuff. It looks great. It looks great. I was trying to figure it out. That's all.
Yeah. Well, actually, for me, it was a new experience because I come from my documentary roots. It's like I use a real plane, you know what I mean? But we couldn't afford a real plane, and nor did we want to go down to the airport, and nor can you shoot dialogue at an airport and blah, blah, blah. So that was the last scene that we shot in the film. Matter of fact, there was a limo waiting outside for the guys to take them to the airport to go back and start Saturday Night Live work. And it was funny because he kept honking the limo. We're trying to shoot dialogue, right? Inside the South. Who the hell's honking outside, man? It's like, it's the limo driver. You're going to be late. Anyway, I just let him go, you know, and turn the camera on because I had like just minutes to get that scene. And they were so tired. You know how, like, you get really, really tired and you just get a little delirious. Well, that's how they were for real. In that scene. They were out of their minds.
Yeah.
And they start laughing so hard, they almost peed their pants.
Is it true that Dana Carvey improvised the thing about Bugs Bunny and then Mike Myers' laugh was real?
Oh, yeah. Hell yeah. That was not in the script at all. You know?
Oh, my gosh. I love that so much. Actually, I meant to ask this before we got into production, but I've heard before, I think you even talked about it maybe on your Mark Maron interview, but that Dana Carvey in pre-production wanted to quit at one point. Is that right? He wanted to walk away.
This is something I heard after it was settled. So I don't know the details about it. I think I would have freaked out if I knew. Maybe that's why they didn't tell me. But do you know why he wanted to quit? Hope it wasn't me.
I think the story that I heard was that his part was just very minimized or something. And so he felt like it wasn't even like he was like, you know, it was just kind of like, why am I even here? There's no point. My character doesn't have anything to do. And then I think that they gave him some more things. So I think he had some ideas of what things he wanted to do with the character. And then they incorporated those or something like that.
See, this is how Lorne teaches his players, which is to compete with each other. And it sounds like it might be a bad thing, but it's not, as you can tell, because it really works. You know,
you get these
comedy teams. I mean, over the span of comedic history, we have to acknowledge that most of the grand and incredible comedy teams, they don't like each other off camera. You know what I mean? And that tension is really what brings the comedy to its highest point, in my opinion.
Right.
And so, yeah, I mean, when I did, maybe we're going to talk about Black Sheep as well. It's a Paramount movie. But when I did Black Sheep, Spade, you know, was complaining about the same thing.
Right.
And so it makes sense that Dana would want his role increased. And to be honest with you, now I recall, we did increase his role prior to production and add a lot of elements that Dana wanted, you know, like the licorice coming out of the ceiling of the car, of the Pacer, right. that was one of his ideas, and the wonky animated hand in the product placement scene, that was his idea, and you know, the heavy metal looking collie with the thing on a wig on, and you know, that was we added a lot of stuff for Dana. It's true.
Yeah.
What was your relationship with those guys during the shoot?
I thought it was good. You know, I mean, afterwards there is this like urban myth going around about how there was so much dissension on the set. And that was really not true. You know, there was some dissension later when I wasn't able to do Wayne's World 2. But during the shoot, I felt like we all got along fine, you know, and, you know, Dana is, he wasn't ever complaining about not having a large enough role at all. And Mike would complain about certain things. See, you get these genius comedians, because Mike is a genius comedian, in my opinion. See, I started out my career working with Richard Pryor and Albert Brooks. And Lily Tomlin, blah, blah. Okay.
Wow.
So you get these genius comedians, and they are, you know, their personalities are very tricky and to deal with. And so, I mean, I was trying to make everybody happy, but, you know, I was used to it by the time I was working with Mike. Mike doesn't want to have butter instead of margarine on his damn bagel, then I, as director, have a responsibility to give him the damn margarine. You know what I mean? Yeah. What, so
was that part of, I think, like, were you able to sell yourself as the director for this job because you had those experiences with Richard Pryor and Albert Brooks? And,
they didn't know.
Oh, okay.
They didn't know that. No, like I said, they just ran out of time. Okay.
I think they chose you for more than just that. They had to, I think.
No. I would say let's call a spade, but I don't want to call it anyway.
We'll be back with more from Penelope Spheris after the break.
Rise and shine, football fans. Start your day the right way with Morning Footy, a podcast that covers every aspect of the global game, headlines, match previews, analysis, interviews, culture, fashion, and plenty of banter. Join as we track the thrills and spills of Europe's biggest title races, the business end of the Champions League season, a summer packed with international competitions, MLS, NWSL, and much more. Subscribe to Morning Footy.
Okay, so you have these genius comedians doing improvisation. How do you direct improvisation? You know, like, do you do it in rehearsal more so, or is it like letting cameras roll and just kind of letting them fly on a later takes after you get it the way it's scripted? Like, how do you handle improvisation when you're shooting?
That's a good question, because if you practice it, if you rehearse it, it's no longer improv,
right?
In my opinion, the script supervisor will have already taken that note. And it's in the script. So if you rehearse it, it's not improv, in my opinion. So here's the way I had to operate, because, like I said, we had a very tight schedule. I think was it 34 days on Wayne's World, I think, you know, and $14 million. Tight budget, tight schedule. I mean, it wasn't a tight budget for me, because I was used to working for pennies before that. Anyway, so when you have a tight schedule like that, you got to shoot the script. You got to shoot what's on the page, because as a director, that's what's in my contract, is that I got to shoot what's on the page. And so I get that. And when I feel that I'm able to cut what I've shot that matches the script, the guys generally would go, "Hey, I can do a better one." And it was usually Mike. "I can do a better one. Let's do one more take." I'm like, "Well, we don't have a lot of time, Mike." But he goes, "No, but you just have to do it, because I can do it better." Okay, fine. We'll do it better. So we do a couple more takes for Mike, improv, blah, blah. And then Dana will go, well, what about me? I'm like, oh, yeah. Okay. So we'll shoot your extra improv now. So, but I knew when I got in the editing room, you see, I've got the kind of brain that can remember all the little stuff and how it's going to fit together. I knew that I had it, and I knew what was going to be cut where, you know?
So, you know, that when you're shooting a scene, you're not collecting just a whole bunch of stuff that you're going to figure out later. You know, once you've shot the scene, oh, I know I'm going to take this bit from here, this bit from here. This is what it's going to be. Like
it's so weird because it's almost like some kind of instinct alarm that goes off, and I see the performance and I know, and I go like this with my elbow to the script supervisor, and she knows she better mark that one because that one better be cut into the film. I can feel it. It's an instinct, you know?
Yeah.
And I mean, it's a great feeling when you see that moment that really works.
Yeah. I have to ask you about the Stairway to Heaven issue.
Oh.
Because Drew and I are, you know, we're VHS kids. We grew up with this movie. I don't think I saw this in theaters. I was 9 when it came out. I probably was just saw it for the first time, I guess, on VHS.
That's really freaky because I was 9 when I filmed it. We're the same age.
But the music in my, what we've seen for decades has always been not the actual notes from Stairway to Heaven that Mike Myers plays. And because there was some rights issue that happened on home video. So in theaters, it was the actual notes. Is that right? But you couldn't get the rights at home. But now the new 4K version, finally, like, they came out, I think, last year for the anniversary, 30th anniversary, has the original notes back in. Is that what happened? What was the situation there?
As you just ran it down is how I remember it happening. When we shot it, obviously, we knew there was a restriction as to how many notes you could use.
It was like Robert Plant and Jimmy Page have to like sign off on it or something, or what?
No, it's the record company.
You're fighting
a monster, man. Yeah.
but they said you could do it in theaters, but not on home video?
No, I think what happened was I don't know for sure. I believe what happened was it did go into theaters with the original 3 or 4 notes, and it, you know, started out with Stairway. It was a great joke, so you really wanted to keep it. And then once I think it went to, was it back then, VHS, whatever, to home video, I think they went, hey, wait a minute, that movie made a whole bunch of money. Maybe we could get some money from that if we tell them we need to get paid for more notes or some crap, you know? I don't know what happened. Anyway, so so then at one point, maybe Paramount went, oh, okay, well, we'll put it out with the real notes, and that way people won't watch it again. You know, you don't know what's going on in the mind of the marketing department. I really never know that, you know?
Right.
And all I can know is that Barry Lyndon over there at Paramount at that time kicked ass and, you know, really made the film work. I mean, they went to the degree of making, when it went international, making little booklets that translated the swing and the knot and the no way and all that, because they don't say that in Sweden, you know? Anyway, I forgot what the hell we were talking about.
That's okay. Stairway. I wanted to talk about casting, actually, because so many supporting roles are so amazing. And I have to obviously start with Tia Carrere, because she is unbelievable in this movie. Such a presence. I mean, didn't she learn to play the bass guitar for this? I mean, her singing, she's so funny. She holds her own, like, in the comedy with Mike Myers, but also, like, somehow their relationship is so believable, which, like, you wouldn't believe that could be possible. How did that casting come about with her?
So I never like to take credit that is not due to me. Okay. However, on this one, I will take credit.
Okay.
I fought my ass off to have Tia be in that role. And, you know, because I know rock and roll, I know how to shoot music. You know, I had I had a music video company. I've been shooting music videos forever. And I know I needed a real musician, a performer who could sing on stage. And yeah, she learned how to play the bass. She learned how to speak Cantonese. I knew, I mean, she's gorgeous, first of all. Okay, so you could stop right there and hire her. And but I knew she could do the other stuff too. And I had to fight like hell for it. And I'm glad I won. And I was right on that one. I won't take credit for the ones that I didn't think of, because I fought Lorne on Rob Lowe, you know?
Okay, yeah, I wanted to ask about him, because obviously he was a controversial figure at the time. And this was kind of a big career pivot for him.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, what was that fight that you had with Lorne about that?
It was a friendly. You never have a fight with Lorne. You'll get killed. But you have a friendly discussion with Lorne. Okay.
Okay.
So I had a friendly discussion with Lorne, and he suggested Rob Lowe, you know, and I said, well, I think that's improper, because he was just in the news having broken some law involving girls. And so let's not do that. And he goes, but Penelope, we could get him really cheap now. And I said, well, he is awfully good looking. Okay, cheap and good looking. Let's go for it. So, but he was perfect for the role. And that was Lorne's idea.
And that was Penelope Spheeris, and my, what a talent, and what a wonderful person. She was very generous with her time, her stories.
Amazing. And we've got more, of course. This is only just part one. But there's just so many great stories, things to learn here that we got out of this. It was fascinating to hear about Bonnie and Terry Turner. You know, they were legendary SNL writers, constantly rewriting. The difference between TV and movies, you know, and how they would write from a TV standpoint, just rewriting. And Penelope had to set a boundary to be like, you can't be rewriting this late in the process.
They created Third Rock from the Sun, among other things, right?
Yeah, they created Third Rock from the Sun, which I watched religiously as a kid, and That 70s Show as well, apparently. So, yeah, good stuff. I don't know. What else did you get out of this, Drew?
Well, I really loved her talking about how she kind of incorporated her background as a music video director or a music historian. We talked about the decline of Western civilization, the amazing trilogy of punk rock documentaries that she made. But it was interesting to hear how that informed the making of Wayne's World. And she's just amazing. You think that narrative and documentary are such different formats, but she really incorporated all these amazing elements in a movie that you would never really think could draw from those same sources, but she did. And it was amazing to hear that.
Yeah. And it just also her approach to directing comedic actors who do improv. And I love that she's able to put it all together on set in her head, the way she described that. I mean, it's easy, especially as a documentary filmmaker at the time too. I mean, documentaries have evolved a bit more in recent years, but at the time you're gathering a whole bunch of footage and you figure it out in the edit. And she was very much like, no, I knew exactly what I wanted from the set, what was going to go in the movie. And I love hearing that. And it was great to hear the story of Tia Carrere.
Yes.
And how she fought to get her on this. I mean, she's magical in these movies.
Yeah, she was really, especially as a young boy of a very formative age, I think you can sympathize. She made quite an impression, let's say.
She was important for a lot of us at a crucial time in our adolescence.
Yes, for sure.
She's amazing. I mean, just so incredibly talented and so good in this movie. Also, I just wanted to say that Penelope was also a producer on Real Life, which the Albert Brooks movie, which celebrates its 45th anniversary this year. And she said on Mark Maron's podcast that she basically taught Albert Brooks how to direct when he made his short films for Saturday Night Live in the 70s, which is really, really cool to hear. I thought that was kind of interesting to share that. Was there anything else before we get into some maybe a giveaway?
Ooh, no, I think we've covered a lot. I, you know, was just happy to listen basically to this interview because I was so sick. So thank you, Charles, for leading the charge and for making that, you know, drawing so many great stories and anecdotes out of Penelope. It's really special.
Yes. And of course, a comeback for part two next week. There's more great stories. We also get into Black Sheep, her working with Chris Farley and on that movie and David Spade as well. And so, yeah, there's great stories and more stories from Wayne's World. But I wanted to say that Penelope went in and approved the 4K color and transfer for Wayne's World. So there is a 4K release, and Wayne's World is available on DVD, Blu-ray, 4K UHD, and digital.
With the original music cues.
Yes, with the original music, of course. And now, finally. And so we are, stay tuned to our social media. We're at Light the Fuse Pod on Twitter and Instagram and TikTok and wherever you do your social media, Ian. And so we're going to do a giveaway of a Wayne's World 4K Steelbook. So stay tuned there if you're interested. And I also wanted to say that Black Sheep, which we'll be talking more about next week, is another movie that's available on DVD, Blu-ray, and digital. And I think that's about it for me. Anything you want to say to our listeners, Drew?
Well, I just want to remind everybody to like, subscribe, rate, and review Light the Fuse wherever you're listening to podcasts. Give us a follow on social media at Light the Fuse Pod. Charles said we're on every single platform, so just find us and follow us. And yeah, let us know what you want to hear, who you want us to talk to. You know, this is a whole new era of the show, and I feel like there's a lot of unlimited possibility. So please keep in touch and let us know what you think. It's invaluable to us. So yeah, thank you all for listening. And as Charles said, come back next week for Penelope Part 2. Spoiler alert, it's just as great as Part 1.
Yeah, and in the coming weeks, we've got more Light the Fuse Presents the Directors. More big names coming up, so get excited.
Great, we'll see you then.
Light the Fuse, the official Mission Impossible podcast, is produced by Charles Hood. That's me, and Drew Taylor. Our supervising producer is Abby Smith. This episode was edited by Luke Burson, with music by Kevin Blumenfeld. This podcast is a production of Paramount Pictures. All rights are reserved.
I'm Joe Dante.
Legendary director Joe Dante.
And I'm Josh Olson.
Oscar-nominated screenwriter Josh Olson.
And nobody loves movies as much as we do.
Nobody's sane.
And we have a podcast.
Each episode, we track down other filmmakers, comedians, rock stars, authors, and artists, and talk to them about movies.
But not about their movies. Everybody does that.
We talk to them about the movies they love and the movies that have, well,
made them who they are.
Which is why we call our show The Movies That Made Me.
From legendary giants to this year's Oscar winners.
We know them all and we've seen them all.
So check out The Movies That Made Me, the Movie Lovers Podcast.
Available everywhere you find good podcasts. Well, actually, it's available wherever you find podcasts, even the bad ones, but ours is really good.
That's the idea.